Stauffer here with you in this hour of the show, which I said was the second hour, which is really a half hour. We lied to you. We did not tell you the truth. Russ Godsey is my friend and my guest. Russ Godsey is my guest right now, and we have been talking about his book, The Repossession Survival Guide. And, Russ, I had a couple of additional questions coming on. First of all, what do you do, and I have heard this before, by the way, before I get to this question, what do you do when people become abusive? I was with a friend one time, and we had the collector up on speakerphone, and this guy just didn't really care anything. He was just downright abusive to my friend. What do you do?
As soon as the collector becomes abusive, and assuming you're not recording the conversation because, let's say, you were at work or it just wasn't convenient to do so, what you need to do is you need to let that person know, look, I know my rights, and I will not allow you to trample them underfoot. At that point, that particular collector will either A, persist and dig himself into a huge hole, which extends a tremendous amount of liability even to the creditor that he's collecting for, or B, he's going to back off and come back to you at a later date with, you know, huge kid gloves on, or C, he's just going to transfer it to another collector to try and just turn it over to them and say, I can't deal with this person, you know, I don't know what to do, and you take a shot at him. When that happens, what you need to do is you need to let these guys know, look, if I can't speak with a debt collector that I'm willing to converse with, that I have the ability to converse with because everybody at that agency just didn't take their chill pill this morning, then the only way I'm going to communicate with you people is by letter. You write down what you want to say and you mail it to me because there is no longer a convenient time for me to speak with you on the telephone. If they call you after that conversation, other than, the management, to confirm that that was your request, if they call you, that would constitute harassment and is against the Federal Trade Commission regulations. And the Federal Trade Commission is the one who enforces the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act of the FDCPA.
I would suspect that there nevertheless are a lot of, since this is what you call a parasitic industry, there are a lot of unscrupulous people out there who would continue to call or continue to harass. That would be my guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, John, just from personal experience, I've seen marriages destroyed because of debt collection. I've seen people having been threatened that if they don't pay their bills, that the debt collection agency will repossess their children. I have even heard... Well, yeah, I know, that's funny. It's a little bit of gallows.
Hey, Robert,
but it's true.
Pack your stuff up. You're getting ready to go out. Okay, here we go.
All right. You know, we're on the edge here, okay? But, you know, let's think about this for a second.
I don't know. That was tempting at certain times, though. I have to admit that. My son's looking at me right now.
This is how serious the abuses can become. Because the debt collectors make their money off of the borrower's willingness to repay, they're going to use threats and intimidation in order to enforce that contract.
It hasn't quite gone through yet. The IRS has been trying to use private debt collectors to collect its indebtedness because they don't have the wherewithal to go after all these people. They've been trying for years, and people have just gotten too good for them, so they're trying to get the private guys after them, which I'm not sure is really a good idea. But having said all of that, all right, so we say we have two processes to go. Effective negotiation, and the other is stopping repossession or other act. They can't take any actions to seize anything, at least as far as money or things. Say there's a non-secured debt until there's a court judgment. Am I correct about that?
Yes and no. A lot of times, they do have to take you to court if you just flat refuse to pay, and that can be a very dangerous proposition. The reason why is, assuming you had a car repossessed, you owed $5,000 more than the car was worth when it was repossessed.
Right.
Now, say it's been 18 months later, now you may owe, say, $1,000 or $2,000 more than that original amount because of interest and fees and repossession.
Remember,
costs.
I said unsecured, like a credit card loan.
Okay, even on unsecured loans, you're still going to have the possibility of a judgment laid against you. Yes, that's true. But a lot of times, people don't recognize that the first debt to usually be defaulted upon is the one that's sitting in their driveway. If they have two cars and they owe $400 a month on as a payment, plus a couple $100 a month in auto insurance, and they put gas and maintenance on it, that's aside from the house payment, that's their second largest purchase. So it usually results in auto repossession as being their mechanism of choice to cut down their budget. And what people don't realize is that once a car gets repossessed, not only do they still owe the money for that car, whatever the bank wasn't able to get to equal the amount of the loan that was on the car, but they still owe the money after the car was repossessed, and they don't even have the car anymore. That's a very important point.
All right, so steps that we go through. Essentially, if they're going to do something, they need your book. I know I've done things, say, for example, in my interactions with the Internal Revenue Service, I use most of Dan Pilla's books, and they work very well. You can maintain a pretty cordial environment and get done whatever has to be done without getting took, so to speak. And if anyone's going to go through it, they really need a cookbook like yours, as I call it. In other words, someone who's been through the process and says, step one, do this. Again, the goal isn't to avoid your debts, but the situations when you're dealing in this gets a little wild at times. And people's emotions get up, because typically if people are behind, they're already stressed just trying to make income and all of the other things that go along with it. And then you have these yahoos jumping on top of you, trying to make your life miserable, and actually capitalizing on that, capitalizing on your emotional instability to try to get some action from you. So A, B, C, D, let's do it real quickly here.
Okay. The first thing that you need to do is you need to let the debt collector know that you are in control, that you know your rights, you're not going to let him trample them. The second thing you need to do is you need to establish exactly how much you owe and to whom do you owe it. Now, they should be providing you that information in writing even before the first contact is made on the telephone, but that doesn't always take place. The third thing that you need to do is you need to make sure you put your game face on and realize that there's just as much negotiations that take place after the debt was defaulted upon as it was originally when you acquired the debt, whether that's a mortgage on a home or an automobile or in some cases unsecured debt. What you need to understand is that you have the opportunity, once you're contacted by a debt collector, to settle your debt out of court so that you can reduce the overall amount that you owe to a mere percentage. It could be as low as 60%. I've even seen debt settled as low as 20%. That's 20 cents on the dollar. Now, their preference, obviously, would be to collect more money from you because then they get a larger cut of what you pay.
But already these debts have been largely, you know, I don't know how it is with the big money center banks, but a lot of these debts have been turned over to collections anyway, and so anything they get is better than getting nothing in their minds.
In many cases, yes. But now that the new bankruptcy laws have been implemented, they know that people can't just throw up their hands and say, well, you know, take what you can get or I'm going to file for bankruptcy. It is more important now than it ever was to learn to negotiate effectively with both your creditors and the debt collectors to make sure that you can save the most amount of money and save your credit and indeed your financial future.
And how do you go about doing that? I mean, some people just don't like to play poker.
It's much like walking into a car dealership and negotiating over a car that you want. In this case, it's reverse. What you're doing is you need to make sure that you fully comprehend that this is a game that they're going to play and the deck is stacked against you from the get-go. They have the contracts that you signed. If you don't have the ability to repay it in full, then you need to find out what they're willing to take that would be less than that full amount.
Question, can you get an intermediary working for you, not necessarily an attorney, but can you designate somebody, say, such as yourself, to be a negotiator for you?
There's a couple ways to do that. One is through power of attorney. Say a mom has health problems, you know, doesn't want to exacerbate her heart condition. She can tell the debt collector to correspond with her daughter or her son or son-in-law, what have you. That would be one way to do it. Another way to do it is if you contact a consumer credit agency, like consumer credit counseling or someone of those sorts. The problem is that those folks often will charge you exorbitant fees and not do very much to earn them. In fact, they can put you in a worse situation than what you originally were in to begin with. Your best case scenario is to learn to effectively defend your own finances, and that way you have complete control from start to finish over what your financial future will look like. Now, it is possible you can either hire or obtain somebody else's services, but that can be very tricky, and it can also be very detrimental for the long run.
Again, the issue is not to avoid paying debt, it's to avoid the chaos. And sometimes, let's face it, like you say, people get into things because of medical bills.
Yeah, the part of the problem is that folks need to understand that banks are very numerical, and they have guidelines for everything, including what they're willing to settle before. And your job as a borrower, especially after default, is to discover what those guidelines are. And that means you may need to do an investigation of your own, or you need to interview your collector in a kind of a sweet-talking kind of way to kind of get this thing figured out so that you can save money, they can get the debt repaid, and you can show on your credit report that the debt was settled in full. Doesn't mean it was paid in full, but it says it was settled in full. And that's a very important point to make. That means that, yes, you had a problem, but that you made it right, you moved on with your life, and, you know, you're done with it. You don't have to risk being sued in the future, so lenders in the future will look at that and say, you know, okay, they had a problem, but at least they made an effort to fix it. That's an important thing to show on your credit report.
Yeah, and it does disappear after, what, 7 years?
It does. Unfortunately, during that 7 years, you may have an interest rate on a car loan of 23.5% or more, or perhaps a mortgage loan that's a bubble payment that may exceed 12% interest rate on a $200,000.
Because you're high risk, let's face it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's do your website, Russ.
The website is repossessionhelp.com. You go to the website. I've got a small splash page, kind of gives you a brief description. I've got a book overview, and I go into detail to kind of give you an idea of what I'm doing there. I even write some articles for under the page called Blog that describes a slightly twist, certainly from a Christian perspective, on debt and what we should do with it. The website is designed to be helpful. The book is designed to be even more helpful.
By the way, it's repossession-help.com. Don't forget that.
And whether or not you include the dash, you'll still get there. The important thing is that the book is only $14.95. I made it cheap so that it would get in the hands of the people that need it most, and I made it into an e-book, an electronic book, where people can download it instantly once they purchased it through the website, and that way they don't have to wait the 5 to 7 days for shipping, because that 5 to 7 days could be crucial, as well as having it in the privacy and convenience of their own home.
All right, Russ Godsey, I really appreciate your taking time with that. What we're trying to do nowadays, over the next couple of weeks, is kick back a bit. This is December, and December tends to be a weird month here for people in North America. Things go on, but as everyone begins to think about Hanukkah and Christmas and New Year's and all of the time off during that time, work slows down, Congress goes home. Whew, boy. Because nobody's life, liberty, or property is safe while Congress is in session. And then it's time to do some more perspective pieces. So that's where we're moving with the program right now. A couple of interesting news items. Guess what? Sharp objects are going to be allowed on planes again, it looks like. The TSA is planning to allow passengers to board planes with screwdrivers, scissors, and other sharp objects. Airline crew members aren't happy with this policy, but I guess they're allowing people to do that. Something that came up that was very important for me and really struck home was the story about Deborah Davis is actually her name. She lives in Arvada, Colorado, where I moved from when we moved to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. She likes to commute to work by public bus, and she gets on the Kipling bus. Now, the Kipling bus is on the west side of the city. I used to ride it. And it runs north to south for most of the length of the Denver metro area. At one point, the Kipling bus turns right and crosses through the Denver Federal Center en route to the Park and Ride, which is right at Union Avenue and the 6th Avenue Freeway. And it goes through the center.
Replays tonight with The War on Reason with Michael Kaufman.
Santa Cruz Radio Show
are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. the views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to tonight's Santa Cruz, Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm Michael Shaw, and it's nice to be back here up in the Soquel studio here above the beautiful Monterey Bay. I haven't been here for about 6 weeks, and boy, that was a good show last week with Tom DeWeese and Roy Avila at the Tom DeWeese show, and then Nina Pellegrini and Paul Dickey made just an outstanding display of how the smart growth and wildlands projects work on a combined force in any region you want to pick in the country. And of course, last week we were dealing with the San Francisco Bay Area, looking at Contra Costa County and looking at San Mateo County. Well, tonight we're going to start a new series here on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and that series is entitled The War on Reason. Things are changing rapidly in America as we transform from the nation of the free to the nation of the controlled. Next week, as part of this series, we're going to have Dr. Edwin Vieira. The title of that show is Why America Needs Constitutional Money. We're going to talk about central banking and the risks that are inherent to the system that now runs the American money system. And in the second hour next week, we're going to talk with Dr. Karen Effen of EdWatch in Minneapolis. She's going to talk on the subject of stealing our children, the federal mandate that your child or your grandchild is soon to be screened for, quote, mental health. Dr. Effen is an expert on the terror that the drugs designed to, quote, treat these deemed mentally unhealthy and what that'll bring to our society. On the 22nd, Terry Hayfield, a remarkable researcher from Ohio, will discuss subjects that will you won't want to miss. Mr. Hayfield understands the nature of the mechanism behind the rise of global corporate socialism. And he also sees the coming of a natural fusion between Americans of many persuasions, all in the defense of liberty. And in the second hour, on the 22nd, we're going to have Robert Theobald, who's an organizer of One England, and he'll expose how regionalism is destroying England. Well, regionalism is the same thing that's happening here in the United States. Mr. Theobald will discuss British Fabianism. Of course, former Fabian chairman Tony Blair is now making the policy for Great Britain. He'll talk about the mounting awareness of the consequences of the European Union as an integral part of the same affliction that ails America. And on the 29th, we're going to have a two-hour special on the all-out war on natural law. We'll hear from Will Roberts information that a $200,000 college degree is just not going to get you. We're going to come to understand who August Comte is and what positivism and the catechism of positivism is all about and how it affects America today and, in fact, the world. We're going to discuss legal positivism and its attack on the natural law and logical positivism. The twisting of the meaning of the words confuse people in order to subjugate them. You see, the war on reason is bringing an awareness to the American people about the blurring of boundaries and the raiding of our public treasury, also that an elite can capture all of America. We're going to be back here after taking a couple-minute commercial segment for our affiliated stations, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Michael Kaufman for the first episode of The War on Reason as we talk about abolishing private property in America.
That's what they're telling me. Environmental apocalypse, Escher. space of the relocating you to an eco-friendly biosphere. Your consuming days are blue. Sustainable development, sweeping the countryside. From the California coastline, we can see it nationwide. Coming soon to a town near you, biological diversity. Yeah, the eco police got plans for you and your so-called liberty. Hey, hey. Yeah, they're gonna save the planet, but not your liberty. Cause when they're talking endangered species, they ain't talking about you and me. Where's Paul Revere when you need him? Guess he's spinning in his grave. Cause the green coats are a-coming, boys. Are we still in the land of the brave? Now all you citizen farmers better think about taking a stand, or they round you up and trade you a cup of kindness for your land. Cause when you're all locked up in cages made from tractors, rakes, and plows, we'll have plenty of time to ask yourselves who's in danger now. Sustainable development, sweeping in the countryside. From the California coastline, we can see it nationwide. Coming soon to a town near you, biological diversity. Yeah, the eco police got plans for you and your so-called liberty. So let's gather up this rotting mess of collectivist policy and toss it on the compost heap of the 20th century. It'll keep alive the principles of individual liberty and advance the cause of freedom in the 21st century. E-I-E-I-O.
Well, that was Barbecue Bob and Sustainable Development. I'll tell you, you know, the whole point here is to keep alive the principles of liberty. And we have ourselves a guest tonight who understands both liberty and the tyranny that's facing America. And his name is Dr. Michael Kaufman. Those who are regular listeners to this show or who are aware of the Sustainable Development Agenda 21 UN globalist federally sponsored movement, then you know Dr. Michael Kaufman. But for those of you who are new to our audience or who will be listening to this on CB Reproduction, Dr. Michael Kaufman is received his Bachelor in Science in Forestry and his Master's in Biology at Northern Arizona University. He received a PhD in Forest Science at the University of Idaho at Moscow. He has taught courses and conducted research in forest ecology and forest community dynamics for 10 years at Michigan Technological University. And while there, he published a book on forest ecosystem classification for the Northern U.S. He also has oversaw a multi-million dollar research program in which he initially became involved with such national and international issues as acid rain, global climate change, wetlands, cumulative effects, and biological diversity. Dr. Kaufman is presently president of Environmental Perspectives. Environmental Perspectives focuses on providing professional guidance and training in defining environmental problems and solutions that, as he says, are based on Judeo-Christian principles of stewardship as contrasted with the pantheistically based environmentalism. Michael, how are you tonight?
I'm doing very well, Michael. How about yourself?
Well, I am fine also, and it's wonderful hearing you, although I've been listening to your voice on that marvelous new online DVD production called Taking Liberty. And before we get too far into this discussion, I just want to say that Taking Liberty is a production that every citizen in America needs to see. The lawyers need to see it. The judges need to see it. Elected officials need to see it. But most importantly, you need to see it. And tonight, what we're going to discuss is issues like the Wildlands Project in the United States, global warming, and the Endangered Species Act. So you've got a big task ahead of yourself, my friend.
We've got a full 2 hours, I think.
I think we do. This will run for 2 hours, so if you're with a station that doesn't get the other hour, then you can check out the Freedom21SantaCruz.net. Go to radio and look at the archives, because this will be posted soon, so you can hear the hour that you may miss tonight. So, with that introduction, what is it we're talking about? Why is it that two guys are spending their time conversing over national radio? What is it that brings us here? Why is it that we're spending time that we could be doing pleasurable things that aren't paying attention to what the realities are? Why is it that we're paying attention to reality? What is it the citizenry needs to become more conscious of?
Well, Michael, it is a very interesting thing that I've questioned, that I've asked myself many times, and every time that I do, I keep coming back to the fact that, yeah, we could be out there enjoying ourselves, kicking back and having a beer or a glass of juice or whatever the case might be, and enjoying life like many other Americans. But if we do, our children will not be able to. And it's as simple as that. Because we are facing a situation right now where there are those out there in this world who would seek to basically take away our freedoms, our liberties, our economic wealth, and the ability to have a middle-income type of living style. What they're heading for, they don't know it for the most part. There are those who do, but for the most part, those who promote this agenda are promoting an agenda that will basically wipe out America's middle class and put us into a feudalistic form of government. It's as simple as that.
And the first step to achieving that is what?
Basically, they have to be able to exert control over us. And Wayne Hage, a good friend of mine, once said that unless you own property, you are owned by someone else. And that is as simple as that. So we're going to be talking more about private property rights later on in the program. But property rights are the fundamental basis of liberty and wealth creation. And I can't emphasize that enough. A major, major study, global study, was done 4 years ago in which a guy by the name of Hernando de Soto, Peruvian national, did a $26 million study studying about seven or eight different third world nations to try to uncover what it is that made capitalism successful in the Western world, especially that of the United States, and utter failure in the third world nations, and it comes down every single time to private property rights. You have to have private property rights before you can build wealth. You cannot do it any other way.
Well, there's no question about that. Certainly the forefathers knew it. But I want to clarify one term you use. You use the word capitalism. And in our subsequent series, weekly series this month, we will be discussing the word capitalism. And the unfortunate thing about that word is that it describes two things that are exact opposites. It could describe global state capitalism. Corporatism, a looming corporate socialism where the government and the multinational corporations partner together. That is often referred to as capitalism. But then there's another kind of capitalism called laissez-faire, which means that everybody owns their own business, their own life, and has their own private expressions. And this is the private property. It's the independence. It's the equality that every person has to go out and pursue their own life, and that includes to create and trade property. And so it's the laissez-faire capitalism, or the free enterprise, that we're talking about protecting. And we're saying that if that's lost to our society, and we're on the verge of it as all of our natural resources are being gobbled up, that's what we're going to talk about tonight. But if we lose that, you will lose your private, not just your private property, you will lose your private expression, you will lose your private life. So we're really talking about the whole context of the American experience, and we're saying, now's the time to take note that a transformation masterminded by change agents is occurring. And the raw excuse given by those behind this is that they're saving the environmental nature of the planet. And no one, in my view, can dispel that persistent misconception than you, Dr. Kaufman.
Well, I hope we can at least address it tonight. You know, the first method of capitalism that you mentioned, Michael, is more aptly defined as fascism. That's basically what Hitler created in Germany and Mussolini in Italy back in the days of the World War II. And it is a form of government that does work, but it is a stifling system of government that is very often leads to totalitarianism, and we're seeing that happen where it's being exhibited the most, where you see this kind of partnerships between big multinational corporations and government. What you see is that the people themselves always lose.
Well, and what we're seeing in the land use area and in terms of rural America is that we're seeing these giant partnerships between huge federal agencies and enormous NGOs like the Nature Conservancy,
mm-hmm.
and local governments and state governments all partnering really in what used to be a conspiracy, but today it's a theft. It's a theft of the American citizens' land and control and management over natural resources. And when that happens, everybody in the city is going to find out that they only get what they're given by the government. They're not able to receive the plenty that comes from their fellow citizens working in their own interests and cooperating with others to bring the people an improving life.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that, and that is so true, because basically they are stealing it from us point by point, little by little, like the frog in the pan that's gradually boiling. We don't realize it's happening until it's too late to jump out of the pot. And we're trying to alert you who are listening tonight to be able to recognize what is happening and to get out of that pot and do something about it before it's too late. And it is, there is a lot that we can do. The Taking Liberty program that Michael was talking about at the very first start of the program is a first step in that. It's not the only step, but it's a major first step, because not only can you view it and see exactly what is happening with the Wildlands Project and the gobbling up of one half of the American landscape and how they're doing it and how they're succeeding and what's happening where and what regions and so forth, but also you can actually get this in CD and hand it out to your city councilors, your county commissioners, or your state legislators, and help them to see what all these wonderful greenways and open spaces that they come across in little forms of legislation are really truly designed to do. It's part of a much, much larger agenda that will break this country into a totalitarian, is all I can say, is a totalitarian socialist form of government that will eventually just destroy our Constitution if it's not doing it already.
Well, the reason I would support your conception that it's a totalitarian movement is that it's not just the theft of Americans' land, it's also this whole idea of indoctrinating our children. I mean, Congress, and people don't know because the news media has not reported it, but Congress late last year passed a mandatory mental health screening law for all children and pregnant women in this country. Now, that's the message that the Soviet Union wanted to bring to society, and it's mm-hmm. happening here in America. It's not just a land-based dynamic. For those who don't understand how citizen ownership of rural lands is key to a free society, they ought to understand that parental control and development of their children is key to a free society. So the attack is coming from many prongs, and of course it's most directly obvious when we look at the property, and we look at how our cities are being rearranged in accordance with the smart growth dynamic, how our rural lands are being squeezed and really cleansed of population, except for multinational corporations and NGOs, and then understand what's really going on in our school system. And at that point, Americans would say, holy smokes, we're in deep trouble. But in fact, we aren't in deep trouble if we wake up. Is that true enough?
I guess it is.
We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Radio Show. We're back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with our special guest, Dr. Michael Kaufman. Some stations, Michael, are out for a commercial break, but for those that are still with us, let's just keep on with that discussion.
Well, one of the things that we attempted to do in the Taking Liberty program that we put together, and I've been working on this since October of last year, just finished it about 3 weeks ago, And actually, it's not finished yet. We're going to keep maintaining it because I know there's a lot more going on out there than what we actually have contained. And if you have any information, you can certainly let us know. And on the website or the CD, we have a place where you can actually contact us and let us know about what's happening in your neck of the woods that's not on there that people should know about. But it is amazing how far, you know, let's backtrack just a moment, Michael. Some of the listening audience may not realize where all this came from. It came out of the United Nations Earth Summit back in 1992 at Rio de Janeiro. And there was a number of things that happened there. Not only were there a number of treaties that came out, including the Climate Change Convention, but also a document known as Agenda 21. And you have talked about Agenda 21 ad nauseum on the program. I think everybody knows what Agenda 21 is. But it first came out in 1992 along with all of these other global environmental issues. One of those was the Convention on Biological Diversity. Now, I have a PhD in ecosystems analysis and classification, have been working on that for a number of years, over two decades, on that issue, develop classification schemes and so forth for habitats, both in the Midwest and for the Northeast where I am right now. And I have been following what's been going on. And there's an international organization called the IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The IUCN, the membership of that contains about a little over 700 non-governmental, environmental, or socialist organizations, plus about 200 government agencies, of which includes the United States EPA, National Park System, the U.S. Forest Service, a whole slew of federal agencies. And according to their 1997 website, you won't find it there anymore, obviously, but according to their 1997 website, they plan to implement what they call an eco-spiritual agenda, which puts nature and nature's needs ahead of those of human beings. And that's exactly what we have been seeing going on now for over 30 years, is the effort to gradually hem us in and make nature the dominant influence in our life, much like the old pantheistic religions of old, where you had to get permission of the witch doctor in order to do anything, to plant your crops and so forth, because if you didn't, you would disturb the gods and you would have poor crops and all the rest.
And you
now,
said
far-fetched.
You said eco-spiritual? Eco-spiritual.
That's exactly what they said.
That's their term, not a term you made up.
And you basically have, within that, federal agencies that are involved, and everything that has come out of the IUCN over the last 20 years, you can see being implemented in our federal agencies within the next few years. Every single thing. And so what you have is an international organization who's ostensibly supposed to be advising the United Nations, which in fact is creating this agenda that is finding its way into your backyard by changing the regulatory system in the United States without one comment from the U.S.
Now,
Congress.
Hang on for just a second, Michael. We're going to be right back. We're back here with our special guest, Dr. Michael Kaufman, who in the break has described the process for the promotion of the environmental agenda that is transforming America, transforming our system of economics, our system of justice, all in the name of Mother Earth. And what we've heard is how this dynamic change has come out from the United Nations, exposed in 1992 at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, and is now working through every NGO and government agency here and around the world to change things into a pantheistic view of, would you call it, eco-spirituality?
Yes. Their word, not ours.
And what we're seeing is this rapid change in indoctrination and land theft, all in the name of eco-spiritualism.
That's right. And it's been a very systematic approach. When we stopped the Convention on Biological Diversity from being ratified in 1994, 2 years after it was introduced to the world, it was the IUCN that actually wrote that particular treaty in 1981, sat and languished for 11 years before it was finally introduced to the world. And it was in the U.S. Senate, 1 hour from being ratified, when we provided the evidence to show that they were, both the Convention on Biological Diversity and the Wildlands Project, and if you don't know what the Wildlands Project is, you should, because it's designed to basically put one half of the United States and every other continent in the world into wilderness reserves and interconnecting wilderness corridors. That's what it's designed to do, to basically hem human beings into what I call human occupation zones that is completely surrounded by wilderness. It is an astonishing, astonishing agenda, and when I begin to warn people back in the early 1990s of this horrendous agenda, I was basically laughed at, as you can well expect, because it was absolutely insane. Nobody would ever, ever do that, and yet millions, maybe even billions of dollars have been poured into this agenda from a number of different sources, primarily foundations, but also things from the international level, going into advancing this Wildlands Project, because it was the Wildlands Project that was also created indirectly out of the IUCN. If you trace all this back, it all goes back to the IUCN. It all has its focal point at the IUCN. And the IUCN created the treaty. The IUCN created what is known as conservation biology, which is the belief or the pseudoscience that nature knows best. And it was out of the conservation Society of Conservation Biology that we got the Wildlands Project with Foreman and Soule and Reed Noss and so forth that we're now facing here across the country, where you're seeing these efforts to put greenways in, open space in, hubs, little wildland hubs and linkages, you name it. There's 100 different names to describe exactly the same thing. And they all are designed to put away about 50% of the American landscape into wilderness areas and interconnecting wilderness corridors.
Now, if that all sounds bizarre to some folks living in the city, let me tell you that when this message is delivered to the timber owners or the ranchers or the farmers, and they actually sit down and see the evidence, they know it's true, because they all feel tremendous shrapnel from all of the, I call it the thousand points of darkness, coming right at them from federal agencies and NGOs. The farmers here in this valley are unable to use their own water in this land of plentiful water for watering their crops. The timber owners in the forest can't cut down a tree. Their forests are ready to burn. You know, and it's interesting, you mentioned three names as being originators of the Wildlands Project, and the second one you named, Soule. Dr. Soule was here at the University of California, Santa Cruz. So much of what the nation is experiencing and will experience in much more extreme terms has been formulated, fomented, and festered here in Santa Cruz for three decades. And,
yeah.
The reality, though, in rural America, that something is wrong is very clear. And the reality ought to start hitting home in urban America when they take note that they're able to visit and recreate much less on lands they used to recreate on, and when they see their roads getting more and more congested without being fixed, and huge sums of federal money coming in to create new transportation systems and new housing systems, they're going to understand that there's something connected between some change out there, both in the rural lands and in our urban cities, that is going to do just what you suggested, which is to hem us in,
hurt us, right,
and then tell us what to do.
Exactly right. And of course, I think you probably know that the President's Council on Sustainable Development, that was created in 1993 by President Clinton, was designed to do exactly what you're talking about. And nearly one half of the membership of the President's Council were also members of the IUCN. And you begin to put all these linkages together, and you begin to see how they have been able to successfully do what they've done over the last 10 years. Actually, the last 30, but the last 10 years has been remarkable from the standpoint that it was the President's Council on Sustainable Development that gave Clinton the authority, the legitimacy, let's put it that way, of actually changing the purpose of all of these land-managing federal agencies for one of helping people to manage right on our land, you know, the Department of Agriculture and so forth, to one of protecting nature from man. in every single agency now, primarily the guiding principle is to protect nature from you and I.
Well, you know, this is the transformation of the entire American vision, which was always held on the idea that human beings are what society organizes around, and that all human beings were independent and equal in their rights under the law, meaning that their potential wasn't limited, people weren't all viewed as being the same, but that they were independent and equal, with equal rights under the law to pursue their life. And what's happening now is that a small elite with huge money forming massive partnerships are coming in, squelching the average citizen, moving in on their lands, moving in on the children, and preparing us for what they call a new world order, where human beings become biological specimens in the pursuit of, quote, the elite's common good. So with that, let's talk a little more about how taking liberty actually digs into the issues of the day and begins to expose the folly behind them one by one.
What I have done with Taking Liberty is we've created it, and we're very fortunate from one standpoint that the geographic information system that they use to basically hem us in and to show how we need to take your land in order to protect Mother Nature is also something that's on the internet and freely available, all except for about 5 states. So out of the 50 states, all but 5 have all of these, this GIS data, and this gigabytes worth of information I was able to download to make this particular program. So what you're seeing when you watch this program is actually their data coming at you, and what they have done, especially over the last 10 years, 15 years, in some cases like the state of Florida, in systematically defining whose land is going to be targeted and going about making it so that that land can never appreciate, and the poor landowner all of a sudden finds that he has to sell his land at rock bottom prices because no one else is going to buy it. It's hands off. The government already has debts on it, and it was called greenlining. And this is happening all across this country, where the government has defined where they need to put one of these corridors in, or one of the reserves, the wilderness reserves, and they have designated that on a map. And you are greenlined if you're in the middle of that. And basically that means they can't afford to do it this year, but they're going to eventually take your private property away from you, either in a form of a conservation easement, are in greenlining where they actually buy your land totally. But if they buy your land, you can better well assume that it's going to be at the lowest possible price that they can offer you and get away with it. Because if you do not, and that literally creates willing buyers, man, because if you know that they're eventually going to take your land, you're going to try to sell it to them at the best price you can get it at, which is right up front, and therefore you become a willing seller when in fact you had no intention of selling it at all. But you better take their offer right now, because it's only going to get worse in the future.
Well, willing seller to the federal, state, or NGOs these days are like the child in the schoolyard who has the bully with his arm up behind his back, and he keeps saying uncle, and you go, yeah, I'm a willing seller.
Exactly.
No, this is, people maybe 20 years ago saw landowners on the fringe of communities have their land that might have been appropriate for housing taken and made non-buildable. So that land became valueless, and so cities then could go around and buy up these green zones. But of course what happened in that is that we all got used to the idea that we didn't have to respect other people's property.
Yes.
And now that idea has spread out to the mass of the American landscape, and it's all being tied up by organizations that are connected to
an international cabal. I mean, let's call it for what it is. And the American politicians are letting this happen, both parties. Now, some people are going to say, Michael, how can this be? You know, how can this be happening and nobody knows about it? And, 5% of the American people have some sense of it. The 95% still haven't seen through. How could that be the case?
There are two reasons for that, Michael. One of them is the fact, and this is not the more important one, but one of them is the fact that 3% of the American the American landscape holds 77% of us who live in America. In other words, in urban areas that are classified urban hold 77% of the American population and only occupy 3% of the land. So they're totally insulated from what happens out in rural America. Absolutely and totally. If you include all developed land in that, it jumps up to about 6%. So you have the vast majority of the American population living in an extremely small portion of the American landscape. So they're ignorant. On top of that, the one thing that you have not mentioned yet tonight that you wanted me to mention, and that is the fact that the media basically has been so indoctrinated in the liberal colleges that what they see is happening to them appears right. Most of them don't have a personal agenda. Because I've talked to a lot of reporters as I've done interviews across the country. They don't have a personal agenda. Many of the editors do, but the rank-and-file reporters generally don't. They're just so dumbed down through indoctrination through their educational system that they basically support this by never reporting what is really going on behind the scenes because they see nothing wrong with it. Why should they report on something that should be happening?
So it's your view that some of these younger reporters actually think that America should be collectivized? And that,
No question about it.
I wonder how many of those folks understand that collectivization of a society, the relegation of human beings to the status of an animal, leads to mass population reductions.
That's a good question. One that I've asked many people, many of these reporters, sometimes in a pretty sharp debate, and they just don't believe it's going to happen because they don't want it to happen, therefore it won't happen. And there is not. I'm also a teacher of world history, and I've taught world history just because I realize how critically important it is to understand what has happened to us in the past so we don't repeat it again. And lo and behold, we're repeating it again. There has never been a society that has survived in the form of liberty what we're trying to do to ourselves. Never.
Well, there's clearly, I think the argument, the case exists that while we don't have an indefinite period of time, we do have enough time to take note of what's happening. There will be something of a painful transition to get ourselves back on road, but failing that transition, the transformation is going to be devastating because, as you said at the top of the show, this is an attack on the American middle class, and if it continues much longer, the middle class will be destroyed, and that has profound effects even for those who are implementing the Sustainable Development Program. Even many of what I call the sustainable mercenaries, those who understand what they're doing and love to get the money to do it, are going to find that as the middle class collapses,
they're going to collapse with them.
They're going to collapse with them because very few of the people implementing this program are truly part of the elite. They all think they're going to get a table, a seat at the table, but that's a shrinking table even if they do get a seat for
right.
a while.
Again, go back in world history and you find that when you start to develop a two-class system, you have the very rich in whatever society you're in and the very poor. And the very poor have never dropped below 97%. Never.
Well,
shocking. In every society that has a two-class system, only 3% are occupying that top class. Or less.
Well, it's time for us to take note that what makes America different is the idea of private property and the fact that citizens own the rural landscape and were able to deliver to those of us who live in the city the goods and products that we need to live. But with the Wildlands Project, the net effect is that we're taking all of our resources out of production. We're consolidating the ownership
between these guys who pretend one thing but are masterminding a dynamic for control of the resources, and they're doing it by fraud, deceit, and muscle. Who would think that suddenly they're going to become benevolent and that they can make soup out of a stone and keep the ordinary human being in a state of freedom?
Yeah, absolutely correct, Michael. It is shocking to realize, the more I study this, the more I realize that unless we get this stopped, we will not have a chance. There's no middle ground in this. We either go and progress for liberty, developing our system of wealth creation with stewardship responsibilities. Don't get us wrong. Just because we're talking negatively about all these environmental things, don't get us wrong. We do have stewardship responsibilities. But beyond that, if we do not stop this juggernaut that's trying to basically gobble us up, our children will not have the liberty, not even remotely have the liberty that we have today.
Well, here in Santa Cruz, it's been described by a head official of the Mountain Fire Team as a juggernaut. It's a locomotive coming from Washington, D.C., and that they just can't stop it. Well, there is a way to stop this, and the way to stop it is first to recognize what the left-right, you once said liberal, the liberal academia, well, I could say, well, the conservative multinational. You know, it's coming from left and right. It's coming from Democrats and Republicans. There is no safe harbor with Bill Clinton or John Kerry or George Bush. There is no safe harbor with any of them. It's coming from both of those sides. The answer is, amongst other things, is to, in your community, simply begin to understand the federal money, the strings that are attached to it, and start to reject it. So if you're in a rural area, you just want to make sure that the federal government, the federal agencies, are increasingly neutralized in your county. And if you're in an urban area, watch for the massive amounts of federal funds coming into your community for government housing programs. It's interesting. I don't know if you saw this recently, but 2 weeks ago, Tony Blair, who's a real Agenda 21 supporter, I mean, there's just some incredible quotes from him. But he said 2 weeks ago, before he had his EU crash, he said that 3.2 million British homes would have to be demolished in order to make way for meeting global warming goals in Great Britain, and that those people would be relocated into appropriated government housing that they're now building with private partners.
And those government houses will probably only have about 500 to 900 square feet of living area, and they will be well insulated so that your energy requirements will not be that high, but at the same time, your living conditions will be nominal compared to what they had before.
You will not have a car.
You will not have a car.
They'll put you on a rail line, they'll assign you a job, and they'll take care of your children.
Yep.
Now, that's Tony Blair. He's a leader in this world. He's with George Bush right now, I think.
Yes.
And they're talking about eliminating poverty in Africa. How do you think they might eliminate poverty in Africa, Mark?
You know, that is the paradox. I was in the United Nations Global Summit on Sustainable Development in 2002 down in Johannesburg. And let me just share with you for a moment my observations. There was a real dynamic going on there that just blew me away. On the one hand, you had Kofi Annan and many of the United Nations delegates basically saying that we must eliminate all of these things that harm the environment. Basically, the very things that you need to do to build wealth for all of these starving African nations and so forth. At the same time, I took a field trip out to one of the old ghettos back in the early 1990s and late 1980s that existed, where you had squatters in building cardboard houses and sometimes corrugated iron houses, just huts and so forth, living in squalor and so forth. Some of these same places I went to that had now had adobe or very well constructed corrugated iron homes, they're still pretty low for our standard of living, but gigantically in just 10 years. I mean, literally just 10 years. And the one thing that they had going for them that caused it with the fact that they had the Rural Development Program put in 1994, 1995 that allowed each one of those squatters about a half an acre of private property that was deeded to them and registered in their name, and all of a sudden those little squalid communities just blossomed because they had private property rights. It was stunning in its magnitude, and here Kofi Annan was 15 miles away espousing the very thing that would put them right back to where they were before.
Well, you know, I think we need to recall, though, when we're talking about a place like South Africa making an improvement, we need to recognize that the property rights that came to those people were granted. Okay, the South African government in no way contemplates the idea of natural law or natural rights. In South Africa, they can grant you some property rights today, and they can take them away from you tomorrow. But even when people only have it for the short time, it shows that the incentives work. But to have our freedoms protected, we must base and premise our entire governmental system on the notion of natural law. That is, that there is a law higher than the law the ruling edicted just now by saying, for instance, that the farmers in Pajaro Valley can't use their own water without metering and taxing and monitoring, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
That is very true, Michael. And I think it's one that we need to reflect on just for a moment, because you remember when our Constitution was written, when we had the Declaration of Independence and fought the Revolutionary War, it was from Great Britain, who was basically treating us as a colony, which was a remnant of the old feudal system. And the whole concept of having a colony was under the old mercantile system, where the mother nation, in this case Great Britain, had absolute control over the colonies, and the colonies can only produce, can only make, can only grow those things that the mother nation itself could not produce or grow. And it could sell to the mother nation, usually with very steep tariffs and so forth associated with it. Only those things, the things that the mother nation itself could produce, the colonies had to buy it. They could not produce their own, even though they might even be able to produce it better than the mother nation. They couldn't do it. And as a consequence, it was a very, very repressive system. France itself, when we fought the Revolutionary War, was still under a feudal system, still under a monarchy. And as a consequence, what we're seeing here is a group of men back in the revolutionary times that understood exactly what we're talking about extremely well, because they could see it happening in the world right before their eyes. And basically, the writings that they made, be it Hamilton or Madison or Jefferson, whatever the case might be, if you read their writings, what you're going to see, it's going to astonish you. The insights that they had into human nature, and the fact that they borrowed a lot from John Locke and his companions, the very essence of the kinds of concept of natural law, and the fact that human freedom, human liberty is a natural law, it's a God-given natural law that the state legislature and the national legislature can never impeach. And therefore, every law that is ever formed from that point on has to consider private property rights, for instance, as a natural part of the law. In fact, Madison went on to expound, and so did several of the other founders, and basically say that the whole purpose of government is to protect private property rights. That's astonishing, given the mentality of today, because most people believe just exactly the opposite today. They would believe that the government really needs to control private property rights for the benefit of society. And that always leads to totalitarianism. And it's not until you have a free market, as you were describing earlier, a free market that can decide based on what they perceive the society wants and produce it for society, that you will have true liberty. And to do that, you have to have private property rights that are inalienable.
Well, that's right. That concept of a free market is another word that the globalists have confused in the American's mind, because a lot of people will object to the idea of the free trade of the Americas, and they do that with good reason. You see, the free trade of the Americas has nothing to do with free trade. It has to do with destroying the borders, the trade borders of America. If you destroy trade borders of any country, then you destroy the sovereignty of that country. And of course, what we're doing with these globalists, these political globalists, corporate socialist free trade dynamics, as we're turning over from the United States to the World Trade Organization the responsibility for determining America's domestic trade law. And when that happens, our destiny is lost. So these trade dynamics, I think, are going to be in for a hard fight in Congress. The globalists took another rude shock here in the last 10 days with their stinging defeats in both France and Denmark, France and Netherlands, of the EU vote. There is this human thrust to have self-determination. There is a sense, I think, building around the world that something's wrong, that a central globalist power is simply consolidating a century of work and is grabbing up assets and is taking private lives, private expression, and private property. The key word is private. You lose private property, you will lose private expression, and you will lose private life. We'll be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show with Dr. Michael Kaufman as we discuss the Wildlands Project. We're going to talk about the Endangered Species Act and global warming and other matters that are so much important to Americans today. Well, we're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio, while some stations are off for a break, with our guest, Dr. Michael Kaufman. Michael, I watched the local or the region section that you had on California and Nevada on your Taking Liberty DVD. And it was shocking to me. I mean, even though I keep up with this stuff, I was shocked at the detail and the progress made in the Southwest in respect to the creation of their wildland zones and the ownership placed in these narrow little public-private partnerships between the federal government and the international NGOs. Tell the audience what you're doing and how you did it, and et cetera.
Well, I was one of the key persons that stopped the biodiversity treaty from being ratified back in 1994.
Let me explain that to the audience. The map, there's a wildlands map that many people, ruralites now in America, have seen. And this map was a map that you drew based on documents that were obtained from Geneva in connection with America's Wildland Project.
That's right, and as well as from the Wildlands Project itself, detailed instructions as to how to do it. I have a PhD in this, so I was able to easily do it, or estimate exactly where these things are going to go. And you know, it's really surprising, 10 years later, if they're actually doing it, they're following those maps pretty closely. It was an estimate on my part based on the fact of my knowledge of these ecosystems and their instructions.
But so you went to the United States Senate in 1994 when they're ready to pass this treaty that would have made it law, and they saw your map, and what happened then?
They saw the map. It just literally shut the Senate down. In fact, well, I can't go in there. We don't have enough time. But it shut the Senate down, and George Mitchell, whom I had just spoken to, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time, who I had just spoken to 2 weeks before that, had told them that this was the Wildlands Project. This treaty was to promote the Wildlands Project, but it doesn't say that in the treaty. And he didn't believe me, so he went ahead and promoted it and kind of brought it out for a vote that particular day on September 29th, 1994. And the day before, and I think this is God's humor, the day before we got the document out of Switzerland, out of Geneva and Grand Switzerland, the headquarters of the IUCN. The IUCN sent us the document that helped us to stop the ratification of the treaty, and it was the IUCN that wrote the treaty in the first place. And basically, it identified the Wildlands Project as a model in how biodiversity must be protected, and we were able to use that. I had been drawing this map for a couple of years of my spare time, and that went out on the Senate floor with K. Bailey Hutchinson. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the vote was scheduled for 4.
All sorry about that, Michael. Welcome back, Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show, with our guest Michael Kaufman, who's explaining how it was that in 1994 his action, combined with some others, presented to the U.S. Senate the kind of information that precluded the Senate from ratifying the Biodiversity Treaty, which was the sister document to Agenda 21. And when this information was provided 1 hour before the vote was canceled.
That's right. It's never been brought up again. However, be forewarned, this year, Illinois, the senator from Illinois, oh, for Pete's sake, I was just thinking of his name a second ago. He was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, wants to bring it out for another vote this coming year. So be aware, we may be asking you to call the Senate and tell them to vote no and how dangerous this is. And this is one of the reasons that we did Taking Liberty, because it goes through the whole agenda of the Biodiversity Treaty, of the Wildlands Project. And even though it was stopped in the U.S. Senate from being ratified in 1994, hundreds of millions of dollars have been poured into this to implement it behind the scenes, where nobody even that's right in the middle of this would even know that it's happening. Legislature has been opened up in Congress to literally force this to occur in certain areas. California is one of the worst, in which they would, by congressional edict, establish this. And the people have no knowledge of it whatsoever. And it sounds so warm and wonderful. Why wouldn't you want to do that? Except by doing it, you're not only taking people's land in the process, you are destroying the very thing that made this nation the greatest nation in the history of Earth.
Well, it's really the security that is what provides the security that we all draw from. And just to take it back to 1992 and the United Nations Rio Summit, the chairman there, a man named Maurice Strong, a billionaire, in oil from Canada. He's probably the second most strong man in the United Nations. He said, when he unveiled the whole program, he said, quote, the current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class, he means Americans, involving high meat intake, which is why cattle ranches are under such attack, use of fossil fuels, which is why our roads aren't being widened, industrial and consumer products, appliances like refrigeration and home and work air conditioning and suburban housing are not sustainable. So we see all that beginning to lay itself out. It is the attack on the American middle class, in their own words. And the reality and the frustration about defeating the Biodiversity Treaty in 1994 is that it has been implemented anyway by nook and cranny and administrative ruling and executive orders and at the state level, the federal level, and it's left us in quite a hole, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it has. If you want to view Taking Liberty, it is on the web. Go to takingliberty.us. Takingliberty.us. Now, if you don't have a high-speed modem, internet access is going to be very laborious. But if you have a high-speed DSL or cable modem, you should be able to work right through that without any problem whatsoever. And we have that on available by CD that you can order from us. Give you the phone number, 1-800-799-9878, and we have bulk discounts because we want to have this circulated as much as we can. That's 1-800-799-9878. That's from 8:30 to 5 o'clock Eastern Time. That phone will be manned. And you can order 1 or 5 or 10 or 20, whatever you want to do, to pass these out, because we can make a difference in Congress with this information. It is irrefutable. I have links back to all the websites of these NGOs to show that that's exactly what they're doing. Anybody that has this can literally become educated within just a few hours.
And it is entertaining. It is a whole lot better than watching CNN or Fox News. This is real stuff. It's done in a professional, marvelous way, and I can't recommend it any higher than anything I know than to watch Taking Liberty on your computer or through the CD from Dr. Michael Kaufman. We'll be right back for our second hour at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show.
Thank you.
expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to our second hour this evening of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. If your station just tuned in to our show, let me tell you, we're going to continue our first hour and our special guest, Dr. Michael Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman has degrees in forestry, biology, and a PhD in forest science, and is the author publisher of a new DVD called Taking Liberty. And it describes how very methodically across this country, parcel by parcel, town by town, state by state, America's rural lands are being taken from its citizens, grabbed up by the federal government, state governments, NGOs, and partnerships between the likes at a rate that is astounding. When completed, the stated goal of those who are behind such a program is the elimination of the American middle class. So it blithely go along with money being printed out by the Federal Reserve as though there's nothing wrong where our fellow citizens in the rural areas are having their properties disrespected, their rights trampled, while the rest of America looks sideways. But you know, the globalists don't have their sights set just on gaining control over the natural resources. They want control over you because they think that human beings are biological resources that are here to serve what they now call the call of Mother Earth. And that's why we're seeing an environmental movement give cover to the establishment of a communist system of justice and a fascist system of economics. If you wipe away the environmental movement and look at what's really happening in our legislatures, our courts, and our land use agencies in America, the privacy is being taken out of property, the privacy will be taken out of liberty, and the privacy will be taken out of life. And at that point, your child becomes nothing but an agent of the state. He either conforms or he suffers. So it's a serious matter when we see our natural resources and rural lands being taken from the citizens of America by global NGOs, federal, state, and local governments. So, back with our very special guest, Dr. Michael Kaufman, extraordinary battler for freedom, an exceptionally courageous and intelligent resource manager. Michael, the thing that I really long for is the day I can have you out and look at the coastal oak forests, because there's some spectacular things happening here on the Central Coast, and your brilliance when it comes to land management issues and techniques and your vast experience with America's major kinds of forest lands would just be fascinating for me to draw from your wonderful depth of knowledge.
We're going to have to do that one of these days, Michael, because I do like that area. Definitely like it.
Well, the Central Coast of California is a special place, and that's why our congressman Sam Farr is so vested with congressional authority to throw all kinds of money in here to the Central Coast in order to move these sustainable development programs along. And in fact, his commitment to this world program is pretty clear. He flies the flag of the United Nations right outside his congressional office. The only man ever to do so in history. We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station. Stay tuned. Well, We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio station with Dr. Michael Kaufman. And for those who've just joined in, give us a quick overview of Taking Liberty, and then let's just move on with the subjects that flow from there, including the Endangered Species Act and maybe a little bit on global warming.
Well, the Taking Liberty program brings everyone up to date as to what's happened over the last 12 years since we stopped the biodiversity treaty. It explains what the program is designed to do, how it got started, why we have it even today, and then go into it region by region, what the federal government is doing in what we call the gap analysis. You've probably never heard of it, but let me tell you, folks, it's in your backyard. You just don't know it yet. And the
what is the gap analysis?
The gap analysis program is it's a gee whiz program, basically based in what they call geographic information system technology. And it is designed basically to look at three layers of information. One is land ownership, who owns what where, the species distribution, both animals and plants, and the land cover type, the type of structure. We were just talking about the mid-coast oak type. That's one of the land cover types. And you overlay those types of things, find out what is protected, in other words, either totally protected in the form of a wilderness area, or at least partially protected in the form of a national park or a state park or something like that, and then determine what needs to be taken.
So
that they can protect more
you mean stolen,
land.
You do not? Is that what you mean?
What's that?
You mean confiscated, stolen,
confiscated,
taken.
Yes, that's probably a more accurate term. In order to take and protect more land. And it's happening. One of the examples is in Florida. We go through Florida in detail and Taking Liberty and show exactly how it's happening. It is mind-boggling what they have done. They've actually expanded in the state of Florida the amount of land owned by the state and the federal government by 11%. In 15 years, 11%. They've gone from 29% to over 40% land ownership by the state of Florida and the federal government in order to accomplish. And what they're looking for is somewhere in excess of 60% of the state of Florida to be put into these interconnecting reserves and corridors, or as they call them, hubs and linkages, in which mankind will not be able to do anything. And they're well on their way. In the western United States, with so much federal land that's available, you know, over 50%, California, 48% of your land is in federal ownership.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Michael. We're coming to a break here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with Dr. Michael Kaufman, who is explaining the gobbling up by federal and state agencies of America's landscape. Now, you say that Florida has increased its government ownership by 11% in the last few years, but that's not including all the Nature Conservancy acquisitions that come in hat in hand with government regulation, knocking down the price and making, quote, willing sellers out of it.
You know, that's a very, and I'll make this point, and the actually brag about it in Florida, how much under budget they actually are. They're ahead of schedule. They hope to have somewhere around 35% ownership by 2005, this year. They're at over 40%. That's how fast they're moving.
And
it's under budget.
In California, it's at 48%. And the other thing that this isn't considering is all the landowners out there who have had their life being miserable, and then the man with a smile and a handshake and some cash in his pocket who says, I'm from the federal government or I'm from the Nature Conservancy, says, if you sign this document here, giving up future control and management, effectively eliminating the private property nature of the parcel so encumbered, you know, tremendous amounts of land. We've had several shows on conservation easements have been gobbled up that way. So it's not always an ownership. It's a variety of ways that the New World Order people are using to design on the innocent American citizen out there trying to make a living on his land. And this land ends up in the coffers of a very narrow international elite.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, maybe not even trying to make a living, but just living on their land, using their land. all of a sudden they find they cannot even use their land for what they want to use it for. And it's not because there is a danger, there's a health danger or something like that in the use of their land. Everybody else gets to use their land that way. They just can't because for some reason someone has drawn something on the map that shows that they need to protect that attribute on your land, and therefore you're no longer able to do it. Simple as that. And then you don't get any just compensation for it.
One of the things I really enjoyed in watching Taking Liberty is that you've got a whole list of terms and projects and programs that you warn people about. And of course, they're just like sustainable development itself. They're all warm and fuzzy terms. You know, if we called it, you know, stealing America's land so the next generation of Americans can be subject to world domination, you know, nobody go for it. But when they call it sustainable development, or they call it community planning, people seem to fall prey to these alluring words that have nothing but poison underneath.
That's right. Unfortunately, you're absolutely right. And until we can begin to, and this is what Taking Liberty is designed to do, is to design not only to inform you, who are already pretty well informed, but to inform your government officials in some capacity or another who are just innocently going along with this because it sounds so warm and fuzzy, can get help get them reelected, whatever the case is, and all of a sudden they can see the big picture and how they're being used. And this is, never ceases to amaze me, Michael, is that most of these environmentalists in the rank and file, they're doing it for what they believe is the right reason, but they're being used by this international cartel. It's being used as youthful idiots, as Stalin used to say, to advance their agenda, and they have no idea that they are basically destroying the United States in the process.
Well, in that process, the way they organize themselves is really what Al Gore said, we're going to reinvent government. Well, government has been reinvented. It's a Soviet-style system of tiered councils that operate by predetermined outcome. That is, we will implement the Wildlands Project. We'll use democracy when that serves our interests. We'll use regulation when that serves our interests. We'll use, you know, beguilement when that serves our interests. And we will buy up. You know, the people doing it don't understand who they're buying it up for, but we will buy up all of America. We will gather up all of the resources. We'll blur the boundaries. We'll raid the treasury. And we'll own all the treasures of all the people, and we'll own their lives. And that's what's really behind this. It's Dr. Stan on his radio show often says this is a spiritual battle. And when you boil it right down, it is about taking control over human beings, and that is a timeless spiritual battle. And the remarkable thing is that for Americans who still live in relative luxury, the reality is that we're only a generation away, maybe even less this time. And the problem too is that the resources, the science, and the monitoring capability is total. So if they got the natural resources, the ability to monitor and control becomes unlimited.
Yes, it does. And that is something that deserves a whole hour of discussion in itself. One of the things that we discuss in Taking Liberty is the Endangered Species Act, because it is up for reauthorization this year. And most people do not realize that the Endangered Species Act has not saved a single species. Now, you won't hear that out of the Department of Interior. They'll claim that they've saved a dozen or so. But if you look back and you find out there's been, 20 or so species taken off the endangered species list. However, most of those were entered on the list with false information to start with. They should have never been on the list.
Okay.
There's about 9 of them that the federal government will claim have been recovered, like the bald eagle. But in almost every case, it was something else that helped in the recovery, not the Endangered Species Act. Because the Endangered Species Act, if you go back and you look at the background of the Endangered Species Act, it was never designed to save species. It was designed to control people. Period. And that's exactly how it's been used over the 30 years that it's been in existence. Because the Endangered Species Act, you cannot, and this is in our Taking Liberty program, you cannot protect habitat. You cannot maintain habitat by keeping a hands-off effort like they're demanding that we do. You cannot manage your land. You cannot do anything on your land because you've got to save it for this species that's supposed to be endangered. The problem is Mother Nature will change that habitat over a period of 10 to 20 years, whether you try to keep it that way or not, period. There's no way it's going to change it. It happens, it's called natural succession, and it's going to happen, and within 10 to 20 years, the habitat that once supported that particular species is going to be gone naturally. And as a consequence, the only way that you can maintain habitat is to create it through management. And if you're going to create it through management, you might as well also benefit. If you're in a forest, to harvest trees, and therefore get some benefit out of it at the same time, because you're going to change that. You're going to change that habitat one way or the other, and mankind might as well also benefit from it. And in fact, that's the only way that you can maintain a certain percentage of the landscape and the habitat that's suitable for an endangered species. You cannot protect it. It just cannot be protected. I don't care who would argue with me. You cannot protect habitat.
Well, it's
it
like
will change.
It's like trying to restore nature. You cannot restore something to a continual changing process. It's like making your 14-year-old 2 years old again.
Exactly. That's a good analogy. I'll have to remember that. You just cannot go back to what it used to be. And you don't want to go back to what it used to be. There's no reason to go back to what it used to be.
Well,
I get a big kick out of this effort to protect the condor in your particular area of California. They're actually doing things that is going to ensure the extinction of the condor because they're trying to protect habitat, and you can't protect it. It's growing up, and it's becoming less and less suitable for the condor. The only way that you're going to be able to protect or to save that species is to go in there and manage those lands.
Well, that's why I say I have a real affinity for the coastal oak forest, because they're very dynamic if they are disturbed. If you don't disturb them, it turns into 40-foot walls of poison oak and bramble.
Yes.
And totally impenetrable to any mammal. And the only thing that really do well in there are the rats. But if you manage it, you can turn an area with maybe 5 species of plants into an area of 150 species of plants, some of which come up only when disturbance happens. See, it takes the disturbance to bring up the plants that are unusual and rare. And if you have different stages of development moving along as you manage your land, you have all kinds of different insects and animals attracted because you've got different kinds of food bases.
You know, it's very interesting. I've done a lot of work out west. In fact, I used to live out west. And you can go down fence lines where they put a fence in. On one side is the Nature Conservancy. On the other side is a ranch that grazes cattle and that sort of thing. Now, what do you suppose has the healthier ecosystem?
The one with the disturbance.
The one with the disturbance. The one of the Nature Conservancy is a biological desert. Because of exactly what you just described.
Yeah. You know, we can go to the new federal preserves around our towns here. There's one in La Selva Beach where they took a poor farmer's land and put a fence around it, put up signs that says, do not enter. You know, it's a weed trap ready to burn, but they said there's a salamander in there somewhere. And so, while the taxpayer pays to give this land over to the Wildlands Project, the property is ready to burn, but supposedly there's one happy salamander that's not being stepped on that's living the life of luxury.
I don't know what the habitat of that salamander might be, but eventually the habitat's probably going to disappear because the farmer was creating the habitat for it.
Well, sure. You know, it's you've got conditions around Santa Cruz now where somebody has made a water dynamic, and then the ugly rules and habitat conservation plans begin to sit down upon them, and the planning department combines with the federal United States Department of Agriculture and the Federal Department of Interior and starts to squeeze down some individual landowner until he becomes a willing seller to the nature conservancy. It's happening here all the time. It's happening all around the country. And Michael, we've had so many guests on our show from every part of this country repeating the same story again and again.
I know of a farmer up in the state of Oregon whose land extends across the mountain, and basically the top of that mountain was shut off. It was owned by the U.S. Forest Service, and basically his cattle were excluded from that. And within 10 years after the exclusion of the cattle, the forest grew up, the pasture, the grasslands disappeared, and ironically, the streams that were coming off of that, who once were teeming with trout and other types of fish and so forth, all of a sudden became sterile. Why? Because it was protected.
Well, I think there's a lot of research coming from citizen forest owners in this county about the amount of water that a redwood, too many redwoods up in our forest ready to burn, but they're also sucking up all the water out of the streams, and the people down by the ocean in the towns are saying, well, there's not enough water in the creeks. Well, it's because the trees are growing too thick, and they're the trees that are taking the water out of the course.
Trees are beautiful, but they do use water. They use a lot of water.
Well, too many trees isn't beautiful. You get nothing growing on the ground. You get a canopy that is not shared by healthy trees. Fewer trees make better trees.
That's right. And you get more vegetation on the ground, more wildlife, because you have more habitat and food and all the rest that goes along with it. And the only way you can create that is through forest management.
Well,
or through fire. Now, which would you rather have?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, when you've had a scheme of management that's gone on in this country for 100 years, and then beginning 10 years ago, through regulation, you were forced to stop, as was the case in Southern California, thanks to the Center for Biological Diversity and other organizations like that, that filed hundreds of lawsuits keeping people from being able to manage their forests in Southern California. And last year, a year and a half ago, came that massive, massive wildfire that burned so hot because there was so much fuel that people died, homes were ruined, and this is part of the plan.
Yes, it is.
Wildlands Project.
And you ask most of these people who advocate locking this land up, and they still will not believe that it's their policy that created this nightmare. It just couldn't be, because they know better. They know that they want to protect Mother Nature, and Mother Nature would respond under their gentle care. Well, Mother Nature is harsh and cruel, and you let it go naturally. You remember Lewis and Clark crossed the Rocky Mountains, the Selway Bitterroots, and they almost starved to death. Why? Because they had ancient forests. There's nothing down underneath there to provide food for elk and deer and so forth, and they almost starved. Ancient forests are really not desirable whatsoever.
You know, man is either put on this earth for, amongst other things, to steward and sponsor the earth, or he was put on earth to be the tool of other men.
Yes.
And that's the difference between sustainable development and America's tradition of individual liberty. And again, our presidents have consistently made their choice. Our Congress has consistently made its choice, and not the choice of the people, not the choice of liberty, but instead the choice of a global collective. You know, people say, well, why haven't I heard about this? There's a quote I've been given that helps us understand this. This is a quote from David Rockefeller, given in Germany in the year 1991 at some meeting. Quote, "We're grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promise of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subjugated to the lights of publicity during those years. But the world is now more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government, the supernatural national sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries." Well, I don't patronize the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, CNN, or Fox News, because Rockefeller is saying it as it is, and for the audience who hasn't heard some of our shows, Joan Villon or Joan Peros talk about the Earth Charter and the Rockefeller involvement in the Earth Charter, what the Earth Charter is, how it's invaded our schools, and how it's invaded our mayors, our council of mayors. You know, the Earth Charter typifies this attitude by David Rockefeller. The Earth Charter was written by Mikhail Gorbachev and Stephen Rockefeller. But we are subjecting ourselves to a global elite who hands out their candy their poison in the shape of candy, and it is leading America down the wrong path. So one by one, we just need to start figuring this out and moving forward.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And the Endangered Species Act, for what your responsibility is when you get the opportunity to tell your senators and congressmen to vote, if we have the option, vote it out, but at least vote it in a way that becomes an incentives program and not a punitive program. Whenever you've tried to use incentives to help the landowner to manage for an endangered species, to provide benefits to that landowner, it works. When you punish a landowner, it never works.
Well, Michael, I agree about the punish part, but, you know, when it comes to the incentive part, I don't necessarily agree with that. A landowner does not need incentive coming from his government to do anything. You know, the reality is that a landowner's interests is best served by looking at the long-term viability of his property, and landowners know that. That's why landowners manage for societal needs. If it's food, then it's going to be put to food. If it's recreation, it'll be put to healthy recreation. If it is housing, it'll be put to increasingly imaginative system of housing if we're free to do it. You know, there's every reason to suggest that well-managed property requires the existence of people. So we should be spreading ourselves out, not cramping ourselves into cities, but spreading ourselves out where we can live and live in a way where we're able to create all kinds of alternatives. For instance, living in lands that are well managed, where it doesn't mean that you have to manage your land to a standard, but there'll be more and more people desiring to, because people will want to live in well-managed natural lands.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. The reason I said what I said was because trying to eliminate the Endangered Species Act entirely is almost a political no-no. It is almost a political impossibility. Given that, the next best thing is an incentives program rather than a punishment program or a punitive program. But I agree with you. Given a total free market situation, what you do then is that every landowner will manage their land as to the best interest of society as a whole. And it's been shown to happen time after time after time.
Well, the problem I have with incentives to landowners is that the look I've had at Congressman Pombo, who's just a couple of districts away from here, at Congressman Pombo's reauthorization of the Endangered Species Act, does two things. One, it throws some incentives, quote, some subsidies, off to some landowners, but in exchange for that, what the act really does is it establishes the premise that all species are of equal value.
Yeah,
it
that's
goes
true.
Further than what 1973's Endangered Species Act goes. It actually cements the concept of the paganism that you talked about in the last hour.
That is very true. I would agree with you on that wholeheartedly.
And so if you are a natural constituent of Congressman Pombo, let him know that you don't want to see it reauthorized. Leave the mess as it is now, because Americans are starting to figure out this Endangered Species Act is wrong-headed. Don't go and reauthorize it for another 30 years on a basis that is even worse, having bought off some interest with some subsidy. That just is the wrong way for Americans to approach this. It could be, it would be a heavyweight nail if this Endangered Species Act were reauthorized on the basis that it's being discussed in current times.
I would agree with that.
Well, there's some new activity in the global warming dynamic. We had Tom DeWeese last week talking about the environmental Earth Day or something up in San Francisco this last week.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Schwarzenegger was there and said that his plan calls for reducing the state's emissions of greenhouse gases to 2000 levels by the year 2010, to reduce it to 1990 levels by the year 2020. And reduce it, get ready for this is called the return of the primitive, reduce it to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. Either they don't expect there to be many people living in California, or they expect us to be living very primitively, I suspect.
You know, I can't understand that statement unless he just said it for politics, because he knows he'll be long dead by that time, and he won't have to worry about what he said today. because it is literally impossible to do what he is claiming to do. Unless we develop a brand new source of energy that we know nothing about right now,
and that's all
coal fusion or something like that, because as long as we have to use fossil fuels, it's not going to be possible. Period.
Let's talk about global warming. You know, that also arose out of the Agenda 21 Rio Accords in 1992, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And for 10 years, I was ahead of a multi-million-dollar research effort on global warming and acid rain for the entire United States. And basically, what we found, you know, in principle, yeah, it could have happened, you know, and for a number of years we were scratching our heads, is this really happening or not happening? Well, we now have way more than enough information to realize that it's not happening the way the United Nations and the U.S. State Department and the EPA say it's happening.
And the way academia says it happens.
Pardon?
In academia, I mean, the kids come out of school and colleges today, I mean, you know, it's like treason to say that there's not global warming.
You know, that's very true. It's become the standard, it's a commonly accepted fact now that global warming, man-caused global warming. There is global warming, by the way, just in case, don't get tripped up on the fact in saying there is no global warming, because there is. The question is, where is it coming from? And there is all kinds of evidence to really demonstrate now that the warming that we've experienced over the last 100 years is a natural warming that is occurring from what is called the Little Ice Age that occurred in the 17th century, 17th and 18th centuries. So what we're doing is we're having a natural warming. It was actually warmer than it is right now back in 1200. That's what they call the medieval optimum, and it was much warmer then than it is even right now. So what we're seeing here is a natural recovery from a little ice age, what they call the little ice age, back in 1700, 1800, in that period. In fact, it was so warm back in 1200 that the Vikings actually colonized Greenland, had quite a few communities there. They're growing crops in Greenland now where there's 100 feet of ice. So it was much warmer then than it is even right now, and it's nothing but a natural cyclic phenomenon that we're going to see over the next eons, that Earth warms and it cools, and it's primarily controlled by the amount of energy emitted by the sun. And the sun goes through an 11-year cycle, a 60-year cycle, a 120-year cycle in its energy output. The more sunspots you see on the sun, which we did go through in the 1990s, the more solar eruptions occur, and the more solar flares that occur. And if you have one of those solar flares pointed at the Earth when it goes off, what it does is it sends out a huge wave of ions and so forth that interact with the ionosphere of the Earth in a way that changes the jet stream, and generally will make it much warmer. And ironically, when we had the greatest amount of eruptions on the sun was in the late 1990s, 1998 and so forth, when we had a major spike in the Earth's temperature, and when we also saw a major El Nino off in the Pacific. Both were related directly to the number of solar flares that were occurring, that were happening to be pointed right at the Earth when they went off. And it's shown very conclusively what for a long time the atmospheric physicists could not figure out, even as gigantic as this influx of ions from the sun is, it's still relatively minor compared to the total amount of energy reaching the Earth from the sun, and they couldn't see how it could influence the Earth's temperature that much. Now that they realize it influences the ionosphere, which is the source of the jet stream, all of a sudden things begin to make a lot more sense. And what we're seeing here is, again, a natural cycle. Now, given the politics of the situation and the fact that everybody is absolutely convinced now that we have man-caused global warming, even though the vast majority of scientists, you'll hear that the consensus of the scientists is that we're having it, it's not true. It's absolutely a bald-faced lie. The majority of the scientific community do not believe that we're having man-caused global warming. There is a small cadre of scientists that are working on the global warming issue. In fact, their jobs depend on the global warming issue. They're being paid billions of dollars And if they suddenly come up and say that there is not a global warming, man caused global warming, they're going to be out of a job. They have a vested interest to keep this myth going.
The sustainable mercenaries, as they call it.
Sustainable mercenaries, that's right. Science has become politicized, just accepted, it's a reality. And President Bush, when he took office back in 2001, he came out and said that the United States is not going to participate in the Kyoto Protocol. Why? Because the Kyoto Protocol was not designed to stop global warming or even to help the global warming issue, even if it were occurring. It's designed to control you and I. It's designed as a massive income redistribution system from the first world nations to the third world nations. It has nothing to do with helping in the global warming issue. And what the solution is with the Kyoto Protocol is that because we are polluting so much, we have to buy pollution credits from the third world nation. And so we have to give them billions and billions and billions of dollars to be able to keep GM going in Detroit and other places around the United States. To keep our manufacturing centers going, we have to pay these countries. There's nothing more than extortion.
Well, this was the whole reason Enron was set up, was it not? To trade those credits. And so the treaty fell apart, so did Enron.
Right. Well, they were exposed. They went too far with the crisis there in California, which was basically created by the Sierra Club, but that's a whole other issue. So I won't get into that. But the key problem is that the Kyoto Protocol never was designed to help global warming. Now, I will give credit to President Bush and his people. They have come up with what is called the Methane to Markets Initiative. I don't totally agree with it, but listen to this. The Kyoto Protocol, at best, after 100 years of effort, might control global warming by 0.015 degrees, might lower it by that much. That's all. Even the United Nations admits that. And yet it would cost the United States citizens hundreds and hundreds and billions of dollars over a 10-year period. Trillions of dollars over a longer period.
Well, and really a changed lifestyle. It's not just the dollars that go off of that, because what global warming is going to be used as the excuse for is the green building standards, which drive up the cost of everything, and the whole smart growth dynamic, which is driving up the price of homes, so that we create that two-caste system, and so that we eliminate the middle class. So, you know, the whole global warming scam, if you will, all of the environmental scares, the state of fears, Michael Crichton called it so aptly, is all about fronting for this new system of government, this new system of justice. The environment is merely the tool to obtain it. So Americans need to look at that new system of government, where it's going to lead us, look at that new system of economics called public-private partnerships that's to the exclusion of free enterprise, and what that means for your businesses and what that means for your children to grow up in a world where we're no longer a representative democracy, we're no longer a democratic, small d, republic, capital R, with a limited government. We become a part of a global democracy where you get to vote based upon how well you're manipulated on the issues they decide they want you to vote on, just to confirm what it is they're doing anyway. And in the meantime, the legislators and the judges sit around and determine what law they want to issue as an edict without anything balancing or controlling their power. It is about controlling human beings. It's about making your children an agent of the state.
That's very, very true. Couldn't be said better. But listen to what Bush's program does, this methane to market. It doesn't go far enough, but yet it is a treaty that was just signed the last couple of months by the United States, Great Britain, Korea, and several other nations around the world. And what it will do, now remember that the Kyoto Protocol is not designed to reduce emissions whatsoever. It's designed to try to control carbon dioxide emissions. Carbon dioxide emissions is absolutely critical for plant growth. In fact, I'll talk about that in a moment. They want to reduce the very thing that helps plant to grow. At the same time, Bush's methane, or the methane concept, will go to reducing the methane problem. The methane problem as a greenhouse gas is 20 to 30 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So it doesn't take as much reduction to have a big bang. And what they can do with this new treaty over the next few years is basically take the equivalent of 33 million cars off the road, eliminating 50 coal-fired electric plants. Or you're talking earlier about Tony Blair saying that they had to eliminate 3.2 million homes in Great Britain in order to meet their goals. Well, this one program by itself, they're going to only reduce it by 1%. And if they reduce the methane emissions by 1%, they would be equivalent to warming 7.2 million homes, and at a cost of a little over $50 million.
Simple solutions to complex problems.
Yes. So true. And you know what the response is by the environmental community?
Well, it doesn't serve the interests of the Wildlands Project, so they can't be for it.
They cannot be for it. That's right. They're basically downplaying it, saying it won't work, and so forth, because they want to use greenhouse gases, because that'll give them more bang for the buck if they can get more cars off the road, contribute to more smart growth, and all the rest that they want to do.
Well,
they're hypocrites. In fact, they are the greatest destroyers of the environment in the United States, American system, that this country's ever known. Simple as that.
I think you're right. And of course, many people are innocent to the purpose behind this. Not all people are innocent, but some people are innocent, and you know, I like to think they're so open-minded that the marbles have kind of dropped down and are rolling on the ground. They need to bend over, pick those marbles up, and start to think about the consequences of destroying private property, how private property and its destruction will destroy our liberty and destroy our life. Now, Michael, you're going to be at the Freedom 21 conference this next month.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about your participation in the Freedom 21 conferences in the past and what this one is.
Freedom 21 conferences started way back about 10 years ago at Kansas City. And they weren't called Freedom 21 at that time. I can't even remember what we called them at that time. But the fact is that they have grown and grown. And it's been one of the primary mechanisms, as I look back over the last 10 years as to what those, and there's only been the attendance of 100 to 200 people. Last year there was about 300 that took this information home and made changes and has literally stopped this agenda, or slowed it down. I shouldn't say stopped, it's not stopped, but it slowed this agenda down, because you're seeing the key, you're hearing the key people from around the country, in some cases around the world, that can explain to you what is happening and what you can do about it. And the last program that we had in Reno last year was dynamite, and the lineup of speakers that they have this year is, I think, going to be equally as important. I'm going to be speaking twice, once on the financial imperialism of the world, what the international corporations and the United Nations is doing to basically hold these third world nations into poverty, even when they're claiming that they're getting them out of poverty. The fact is that their mechanisms and so forth are designed to keep them into poverty in perpetuity, and put us into poverty in the same way over the next two decades. And the other thing I'm going to be doing is explaining this Taking Liberty program a little bit more over a two-day period.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. You know, for the listening audience, there will be Joan Vion, who's been a guest on this show. We'll talk about how global governance is advancing. I mean, behind this whole environmental movement, again, is this global governance concept. And so there's a lot to understand of that. Niger Ennis, spokesman for the Congress of Racial Equality, will be speaking on the anti-freedom policies that are affecting the poorest people in the United States and the developing world. And you know, that's what this is, where this whole sustainable development dynamic is going, is it will create poverty. You know, I look at that, I look at this idea of Great Britain going into Africa to end poverty, and see how they're working so hard on this global basis to eliminate America's middle class, and I have to wonder what kind of mechanism they'll use to end poverty in Africa.
They can't.
Well, the
mechanism they're using will not end poverty. The only thing that will end poverty is private property rights.
Well, or death.
Or death. That's correct. Yeah, you got a point. You got me there.
Okay. Dr. Fred Singer is going to be at the conference talking on global warming. Jim Beers will be there talking about the Invasive Species Act. Tom DeWeese. Boy, it's just a whole lineup of great talks. And Madeline Cosman will be there. So if you've got a chance to make it in Reno, I would suggest to the audience get your reservation. You can go to freedom21.org, Henry Lamb, and find out more information and make reservations.
Yeah, it should be a very good, if it's anywhere close to where it was last year, it'll be the most impressive program that you've ever seen.
Well, and it is making increasing ripple effects across the country because there's email lists that are growing every day with information spreading and with tools like taking liberty or tools like the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Guide, the Guide to Understanding Sustainable Development.
Yes, excellent.
You know, we're now in our second printing, Michael, and the pace of the sale of this just keeps accelerating.
What excites me about that particular program is that, you know, it's designed for Americans because we use American examples in it, but yet other nations are picking it up and running with it because it affects them the same way, even though they don't have the same governmental structure.
Well, this guide is moving through England right now very rapidly, and if one person comes to understand this dynamic, the osmosis multiplies it many times over, because family and neighbors and associates begin to catch on. If with every person who sees the picture of sustainable development is able to communicate in little but meaningful ways to people around them, so that's how this is going to spread. And when we all get the information about what's really happening, boy, the American know-how will put itself to work and figure out a way to make right and to launch us back onto our real vision of individual liberty and equal justice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's exciting to see what is happening. What was exciting to me when I was in South Africa in 2002, we stopped basically the acceptance by the United Nations of the Earth Charter. And it wasn't me and Henry Lamb and Tom McDonald like we did with the Biodiversity Treaty that did it. There was over 100 people from all over the world that was fighting that thing. They understood it. It was exciting to see. I had very little to do with it this time around, but yet I was there to see it happen. And it was exciting to see so many people coming together, because now it's becoming more and more widespread all across the world what these people are trying to do. And people are coming from everywhere to try to stop it. And you can be part of that.
Well, you know, any citizen, you know, evil prevails when good men do nothing. So there's a lot of people in America who are not listening to this show tonight, but they can listen to it later on. And what we need to do is just start methodically spreading the information. We don't have a lot of time. We need not panic, but we need to start getting busy.
Yes.
You know, and one of the steps I always like to suggest to people is that they take control of their children's development. Because our school system is, and it's moving real fast, it's happening very quickly in our school system, the change in focus, the change in purpose, all things seem to be changing. Even our fire policy here in Santa Cruz, we now have the International Fire Code that puts life, not human life, just life, meaning any species life, number one, and the defense of property, number three, behind defense of the environment. So that's a complete restructure of the traditional American notion about how you fight fires, which is to protect human life and property. As
right.
Number one, number two objective. So it's happening in so many ways. It happens in all the little boards, the water boards and the fire boards and the school boards. And the first thing you can do is save your child, protect your child from that kind of influence that will leave them willing and compliant citizens to a new world order.
I agree. And you think back a couple of years ago when we had the massive fires in the state of Washington. There is a classic example of what happens when you have this muddled mental thinking of nature comes first, where you had the Forest Service spending hours and hours arguing over whether they should be dropping slurry over five firefighters to protect them from a fire that literally surrounded them and was approaching on them. And finally the firemen burned up. Because they were arguing over whether they should use slurry, because slurry could get into the creeks and hurt the endangered cutthroat. Not cutthroat, but the, one of the endangered trout. And it astonishes me. But there's a classic example of what happens when you put species first. It is a classic example. I was on a fire in Montana 3 years, 4 years ago, in which started. And it was a couple acres in size, but they pulled all the firefighters off that night because it's dangerous out there at night, you know? I used to fight fire at night all the time. Yeah, it is dangerous, but you have to do it because that's when you can succeed on a fire. You have to take the risk because that's when you can beat the fire back. And they put them out at 10 o'clock the next morning. By that time, it was about 500 or 600 acres, and in 2 days, it had burned 50 million acres.
My.
It just... Not 50 million, I'm sorry, got a floating decimal point. It's 1 o'clock my time. 50,000 acres. We drove for 50 miles where it had run, it had paralleled one of the highways there. We drove for 50 miles, and if they had fought it the way it should have been fought, with using slurry, but they couldn't use slurry because it might hurt those little trout. Of course, the trout streams have all dried up. Trout were dead anyway. The streams evaporated or boiled, as the case might be. They were dead one way or the other. And so by worrying about this, we lost tens and tens of thousands of acres of forests and streams and everything else.
You know, what I've observed from the quote environmental scientists that I run into here in California, particularly in Santa Cruz, is that most of them, you know, and I was raised in a city and only bought rural land as a, you know, 20 years ago, but it's very clear to me that many of them really have no idea what they're doing.
No, they don't. It's all feel good.
Yeah, they have no sense about how it's like a child. If you know nothing about a child, you can't nurture the child. Well, these folks don't know how to nurture the land and can't recognize when land is being nurtured.
No.
It's an agenda. You know?
They have a frozen idea in their minds that the only way that you can nurture land is by protecting it and keeping people off. And that's usually the worst thing you can do.
That's why we say that sustainable development is anti-human, it's anti-life, and it's anti-property.
Yes, it is.
You know, for our listeners, we talked in the last hour, and we'll have to do that again, how it is you can order your copy of Taking Liberty so that you can hand it out to university professors or lawyers or next-door neighbors or family members, etc. You know, it's something that would make a great summertime Christmas present, whether you live in a rural or urban area. But for our regular listeners who want to help distribute Taking Liberty, you can fund a distribution of Taking Liberty by Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. Just call us or send your check to Post Office Box 3330, Freedom, California. That's Box 3330, Freedom, California, 95019. You know, the real question is, do you want to see private property in America abolished by continuing the federal implementation of a political globalist plan called sustainable development? If not, don't sit back and do nothing. Just watch and circulate Taking Liberty. Because one of the big goals that I have, one of the big hopes I have, is that Taking Liberty steadily, steadily, steadily spreads around this country and people begin to see the light. You know, I always say, Michael, it's like managing native grasses here on the central coast of California. You know, you fight the European pasture grasses for a decade. Every year you're trying to beat back that seed bank, and then suddenly something pops up that hadn't been there before. You get identified, it's an indigenous California plant, and it goes along for a few years, and finally it goes like wildfire. It just catches on. It spreads over a particular area, and then other things start to grow up under it that are all luscious and luxurious as the California landscape would be. And that's how freedom's going to move. And the way it's going to move is by by examples like taking liberty being spread around this country. So gather unto yourself and make an investment. Contact Michael Kaufman or Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. You can reach us at 831-684-2232. And how can they contact you, Michael, to get...
Again, if you're interested in Freedom 21, 1-800-799-9878 from 8 o'clock to about 5 o'clock Eastern Time. Or give us a call at 207-945-9878 if you have some questions, because this is a huge program, and the more we can spread it, I think the more effective that we can be. And what Michael's doing with Freedom 21 Santa Fe, or Santa Cruz, with their sustainable development pamphlet and so forth, is yet another tool to help people understand what is happening.
Yeah, it's a big behemoth, you know, with millions of pages coming out from Switzerland and New York and Washington, D.C., you know, and to get it down to where the average citizen can digest it has been a challenge. And nobody's worked at that longer and harder than you have. I mean, I suppose there's a few guys like Andrew Lamb, et cetera. You know, I'm a Johnny come lately to this dynamic. We've been working on it here for about 4 years. But it has taken this much time for people to be able to really digest a massively comprehensive, brilliantly strategized, and if you think the devil can be brilliant, program for taking freedom, taking liberty in America. And it starts out in our rural lands, because once they've got the rural lands and natural resources, it's easy to be to subjugate the people.
Yes, it is. Very definitely. Well, I think we've had a good program here tonight, Michael, and hopefully many of you who are in the listening audience will take advantage of it. But, you know, take the program and give it to others. You sell the CDs, don't you, Michael?
The Taking Liberty CDs?
No, these 2 hours of...
Yes, we do. We will be making archives of this, and we will be making CDs of it, so you can call our number. Again, that's 831-684-2232. And you can order a single copy or multiple copies of the guide, and you can look at our radio archive and decide what radio shows you want to hear. And I'm so happy to have had you on this first session of what we're calling the War on Reason. And in this case, it's the circumstance of abolishing private property through the Wildlands Project and the Smart Growth land use elements of the Sustainable Development Model designed to subdue the United States of America. It takes our water, it takes our resources, it takes our timber, it takes our minerals, it takes our ranch lands, and it puts it in the hands of a narrowing global elite. People like organizations like the Nature Conservancy and the tremendous land grabs are being undertaken by state and federal governments.
Absolutely. And the more we can share that with other people, you know, you can't come across as a zealot when you talk to people that don't know about this, but you can come across as a friend and someone that is very concerned about what they're hearing, and share that information with them, and let the information itself demonstrate to these people what is really happening. Because you have to go, and you probably realize it yourself. The first time you're exposed to it, you went into a state of shock. With all your friends and your relatives and so forth, when they first hear about it, recognize that. Let it happen. It's got to nurture there for a while, and then keep feeding them more and more information to help them to frame this understanding. Once you see Taking Liberty, for instance, and I'm sure it's true with many other things, once you see it, you're going to be able to see it in your newspapers, in your evening news reports, happening all around you, whereas before you never saw it because you never knew what to look for.
Well, that's right. You know, it's you never read the newspaper the same, and there's no better example than the Dow Jones Company's local newspaper, the Santa Cruz Sentinel. If you want to understand, once you know sustainable development, take a look at their stories online if you don't live in this area, and you can see how the newspaper, the New World Order, operates. Michael, I want to thank you so much for being with us on this 2 hours, and it's late back there in the East. It's still a young night here in California, but until we do this again, have a great life, and I'll look forward to seeing you in Reno, Nevada.
Thank you, Michael, myself included.
Great. Good night.